This is Legends and Legacies with Mark Wade.
Good morning. Listen to 101.9 High FM. My name is Mark Wade. The program is Legends and Legacies, a history of South African Jewry. Today I have in studio Rabbi Dr. Moshe Singer. We're going to be discussing the exceptional contribution that South African doctors and physiologists have made to the history of South African Jewry, their contribution to our country, in fact. Going back to 1951, we have Max Thieler, who received a Nobel Prize. He was actually the first African to receive a Nobel Prize, the first South African and the first Jew. We do have a number of other Nobel Prize winners over that time. Aaron Klug in 1982. Then we have Nadine Gordimer, who won a Literature Prize in 1991, although we can't include her amongst the doctors. Then we have Sydney Brenner, who won an award for physiology and medicine in 2002. And then Michael Levitt for chemistry in 2013. So, Dr. Singer, welcome. Thank you very much
for joining me
in the show. As the introduction said, Jewish South African doctors have made, and physiologists, have made an incredible contribution towards the history of South Africa. Of the 11 Nobel Prizes that South Africans have won, 5 have been won by South African Jews. That's an outstanding figure.
Yeah, it's even bigger than the general percentage worldwide of Nobel Prize winners. 5 out of 11 is almost 50%. Worldwide, there have been just over 22% of all the Nobel Prizes throughout time have been won by Jews. So our contribution in every sphere has been really remarkable. We're a small population, but education has always been of primary importance, service to the communities have always been important, and the contribution that Jews have made over many, many centuries is far in excess of our smallish numbers within the world population. So South Africa, doctors, well, I'm a doctor here. I've been a doctor for over 30 years, and always grown up with a situation or a feeling that doctors around, many are Jewish. I grew up with a father who was a doctor, an uncle who was a doctor, another uncle a doctor, and it's just been part of Jewish life that doctors have often been Jewish, have often been big people, big contributors to society, and in every sphere of medicine.
Well, every Boba wants her grandson to be either a rabbi or a doctor, and you both.
Yeah, that's it. You know, my son, the doctor. I managed to be one myself.
Yes, very nice. So I believe there's uncertainty as to whether Max Thieler was Jewish or not. But he is listed. And what are your thoughts on his contribution?
Well, Max Thieler, okay.
Is it Thieler, sorry.
If he was Jewish, well, I'm very happy. But as a South African, he certainly was of vital importance. He was involved with the research, amongst other things, of viruses. And he was educated here in South Africa, in Pretoria, UCT, went on eventually to Britain and finally on to the United States, and was involved in tropical medicine, and spent many years investigating diseases, amoebic dysentery, trying to develop a vaccine for rat bite fever. And as he got working further and further, he started getting involved in yellow fever. Up to the earlier times, there was a hypothesis that yellow fever was caused by a bacterium rather than a virus. And he showed, 1928, that it was actually a virus, and went through various processes within the laboratory in injecting virus into rhesus monkeys, and finally was able to isolate the vaccine. And because of his contributions, yellow fever barely exists in the world anymore as a disease. It was quite an amazing amount of work that he did. He was given a Nobel Prize, and certainly was the first South African Nobel Prize winner in 1951. Went on and got other awards. And for anybody who is involved in medicine and tropical medicine, for sure, he was of absolutely vital importance to whatever he had done.
So then we go on to Dr. Aaron Klug, who won the Chemistry Prize in 1982. Now, The work he did is described as crystallographic electron microscopy, which I believe is the CAT scan.
It's actually the electron microscope, which is slightly different. Aaron Kluk, just a bit of background, was born in Lithuania. He was educated in South Africa and then went on to England eventually. He was the fellow, he got an FRS. Electron microscopy is slightly different to a CAT scan. A CAT scan is a computerized aided X-ray where numerous X-rays are taken and by computer are able to find a picture of whatever's going on with that part of the body.
So that's when people lie on a bed and they almost go into that huge donut-looking thing and...
Absolutely. Whether so it's that one or it's going to be the MRI scan.
It's not that.
No, it's not quite that. Okay. Electron microscopy is where the using electrons and minuscule size of a microscope, electron microscope, then they're able to look at minute particles, minute viruses, and blow those up as a microscope rather than an X-ray, which is a macro picture. It's an absolute micro situation rather than a macro picture would be a CAT scan.
Okay.
And he was involved in working out acid protein complexes. He developed, amongst others, the electron microscope and was of major importance in terms of all development of an understanding as to microscopy. Using various viruses he was able to deal with. He worked on Cochrane and Crick's theory in terms of the double helix, the structure of DNA, and was able to further that research over many years. In 2005, he was actually given a South African Order for exceptional achievements in medical science.
So is that very similar then to the work that Sydney Brenner was doing?
It is. Sydney Brenner, who was a South African and born in South Africa, won the Nobel Prize in 2002, was also working on structure of proteins. Sydney Brenner was quite a genius. He started medical school at the age of 15, and in second year, it was noted that he was too young to qualify as a doctor at the age of 6 years. So he was allowed to do a BSc in anatomy and physiology. He stayed on a couple more years and then did an MSc and finally finished medicine. So he was taught by some of the famous medical scientists, Raymond Dart, Robert Broom, who are anatomists, and he started working in cytogenetics, which essentially is similar to the work in DNA, RNA, worked on by Watson and Crick, and similarly in America was an extremely important scientist in developing the understanding as to protein and cell structure.
So as you explained to me earlier, we're dealing more with the physiology than with pure medicine.
In terms of these awards, yes. And that's fine.
Does that apply to Michael Levitt as well, who developed a computer program for studying the conformations of molecules?
Again, he was a chemist,
I suppose,
and he wasn't really a doctor. Okay. So, but talking about doctors, and maybe we can just go into that a little bit, because as clinicians, which is really what medicine is talking about, clinicians, we've had a really long legacy of clinicians from GPs through all the specialities, surgeons, physicians, cardiologists, and famous people who were involved with really essential parts of research and on treating patients. As a kid, I grew up in Zimbabwe, and one of the people I was related to by marriage was Professor Michael Gelfand, who was a specialist in tropical medicine. He was one of the founders of the medical school at the University of Zimbabwe, University of Rhodesia at the time, was born in Wynberg, went to school in Wynberg, UCT, went on to England, and his contribution to medicine and sociology has been unbelievable. He was involved with the research into Shona customs at the time. He wrote one of the primary textbooks of tropical medicine, The Sick African, which has been essential in terms of understanding as to the psychology and the sociology of illness in addition to the pure medical treatment of patients, it's far too often shown that doctors around the bedside will refer to this illness rather than this person. And Prof. Gelfand, who was eventually given a knighthood by the Pope, believe it or not, as a Jew, and was Prof. Gelfand wore tzitzit until the time that he died, was very much involved in the people, the patient as a person, that the importance of understanding how the patient needs to be regarded as an individual rather than as a disease. And if you don't look at a patient properly, you'll never really get to the point as to where you can really treat him. That's gone for many, many doctors, great physicians, brilliant men who over the years have done tremendous things for medicine within South Africa.
I have a very good friend who actually gave up being his practice as a GP because he felt so many problems that people had today were psychosomatic. And I think he, talking about the bedside manner, that he felt he wasn't treating any symptom. You know, the symptom really was maybe psychological. And as a GP, it wasn't really his place to do that. And I think, sadly, he left the profession and he now works for an HIV AIDS NGO, when he feels he really is treating people who do have serious problems that need attention. And I think he felt, as a sort of suburban doctor, he really got quite tired of dealing with people who weren't really well, who just felt that they wanted to be ill, if that analysis makes any sense at all.
No, I certainly do understand. I think the primary role of a general practitioner, if we're going to talk about that, is really in the wellness of his patients and an understanding as to the dynamics of illness or wellness. And a good general practitioner needs to be aware that much of the illness or possible illness of his patient may not be totally physical. There's the story of the hand on the door where mothers, for example, bring their children many times into the doctor, and it's just an excuse for them to come and see the doctor and have her problems dealt with, which is often not done. But I think an astute doctor, a kind doctor, will be able to understand that. And general practice is the beginning of all of that. Unfortunately, there is an idea that everything needs to be done by a specialist, that you need a specialist surgeon, you need a specialist pediatrician, a specialist cardiologist, and most things are beyond the scope of a GP. And we know that's not really so. There have been myriads of tremendously competent GPs, and I understand in your friend's situation where he maybe felt a little bit out of his depth and wanted to get into a more kind of global approach to medicine as to why he went into HIV research. But the personal approach is really one of the reasons why South African doctors have been so highly regarded over the years. There's a kind of a menschlichkeit, there's a kindness, as I say, amongst Jewish doctors, and a breadth of more than just medical knowledge.
Yes, I agree with you that that is necessary. You know, you want to feel that your doctor is more than just a consultant; he's a friend of yours. And really is looking after your interests.
Yes.
So actually we're going to have a short break and we'll be back.
This is Legends and Legacies with Mark Wade.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Mark Wade. The program is Legends and Legacies, a history of South African Jewry. In studio I have Dr. Moshe Singer, who happens to be a rabbi as well. He's a doctor in general practice. We're talking about the exceptional contributions that doctors and physiologists have made, Jewish doctors and physiologists have made to our country. And many of them have made contributions that have been recognized worldwide. As I mentioned earlier, of the 11 Nobel Prizes that South Africans have won, five of them have been South African Jewish doctors. Unfortunately, most of them have left the country and set up their practices elsewhere. Many of them have joined international institutions and have developed their research from there. Rabbi, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
So we were chatting about the kind of, do we call it bedside manner? Do you think there's a particular aspect of maybe Jewish ethics in medicine that determines the way Jewish doctors think, or do you think it's just the what doctors should do?
Okay, that's quite interesting. You're asking it as a rabbi, as a doctor, because to some degree,
fortunately, I can ask you as you are both. You know,
well, as a rabbi, and this is really what's got to do with this. There are a couple of reasons as to why doctors need to treat. First of all, it says in the Torah, "Verapo yerape," that the doctor has an obligation to treat a patient, and Hashem gives that doctor the ability to do that. He gives him a degree of knowledge and with experience, and there's an obligation in many ways. The doctor's obliged to treat his patient. The patient, to some fair degree, is kind of, I don't say obliged because that's too strong a word, but there's a necessity of the patient to also want to be healed and to be part of that contract. And we don't believe that the world is just going to continue along a set line and you don't have to do anything to help your own health. There's a commandment to look after yourself. In other words, look after your health, your mental health, your physical health, not to do anything that's dangerous to yourself. And that's for yourself. On the other hand, there's an obligation on professionals to provide the ability for that patient or that person to get better. There's another mitzvah which is quite interesting in terms of returning a lost object. A doctor is necessitated to return a patient's health to himself.
I never saw it that way. So that's an interesting observation.
Yeah. So as you say, you introduced me in this part as Rabbi Singer. Well, Rabbi Singer, I do brisses as well. And I think to some fair degree, it does add to my practice if I realize that it's not all on my shoulders, that whatever I do is not totally dependent on me, but Hashem has a part to play within the whole story as well. I try to realize that I'm only really a messenger of Hashem, and that Hashem brings his cure through various people. There are many shlichim, there are many messengers for Hashem, and thankfully it gives an ability for a doctor to be part of a framework where there are other people who will also help to provide healing for that patient. It's not all only the doctor, but the physio, the radiologist, the radiographer, the laboratory person, all is part of helping that patient to get better.
Are there specifics to medical ethics within Judaism that are different to within the Christian world?
Or a secular world rather than a Christian world.
A secular world.
Well, they're going to be very much tied together. There is the so-called Hippocratic Oath, which we at UCT didn't take the direct Hippocratic Oath. We took a declaration to treat our patients in the best possible way when we left medical school. So there is an obligation in many ways to treat your patient in the best possible way. And generally speaking, secular ethics are going to cross over in terms of, as well into the realm of Jewish ethics in terms of healing. There are, however, sometimes going to be situations where there may be a minor degree of conflict, and halacha, which looks at all these problems, occasionally may come to a head-to-head situation in terms of ethical behavior. What do I mean by that? Up to now, for example, the understanding as to when death occurs has been slightly different to between the Jewish religion and secular ethicists.
Well, that even goes back to Chris Barnard's original heart transplant.
Absolutely.
In terms of what the American definition of what dead is and what the South African definition
Without
is.
A doubt, which was part of the reason why Chris Barnard was able to do the first heart transplant. There's an amazing book called Every Second Counts, which tells the story of the first heart transplant. Essentially, there was a race between Chris Barnard, a Dr. Cantor Roberts, and a third cardiologist, not Dr. Cooley, I can't remember his name offhand. But the situation in America was that the ethics committees of the hospital blocked the ability of the surgeon to remove a heart from the donor each time because there was a question as to whether the person had died. It was slightly more liberal in South Africa at the time, and generally speaking, since then, brain death has been the measure as to somatic death. In other words, the death of the patient has been relied on to be brain death, in spite of the heart continuing. The decision in South Africa up to now, as far as I know, has been that the brain death is the criterion of patient death. Halakhically, up to now, that hasn't been so. It's been what's called the permanent, irreversible cessation of respiration and heartbeat. In other words, when the heart stops beating or the person can no longer breathe, that is when death takes place. And I've been led to believe that recently now, in Israel, they are re-looking at that situation, that possibly the definition of somatic death may be changing in terms more along the lines of brain death, which will then tie together secular ethics and Jewish ethics along that line. But that's just one example. Jewish ethics are absolutely vital and have been part of our approach to medicine and illness forever. And that regards, with that regard, it's to whether to treat on Shabbat, how to treat on Shabbat, what to treat, how to give a patient medication, in terms of modesty, with having to have chaperones. And that has always been a very careful situation with Jewish doctors, to not allow ourselves to be in any compromising situation, both as a doctor and just as a regular Jew. So ethically, that's been part of what we've done forever.
So if we then go back to the exceptional record of South African Jewish doctors, going back to what I was referring to earlier with Nobel Prizes, do you think there was a drive then for them to achieve such greatness in the medical world over and above their numbers? You know, to me, it just seems so skewed. You know, in the list of the Nobel Prize winners, there's not one other person other than a Jew. You know, to me, that's an extraordinary figure.
And it is.
Does it have anything to do with Judaism, or do you think really it's more the nature of the Jewish family, the nature of the Lithuanian community who came to this country?
Okay, in one question, you've really asked many. I think we shouldn't just concentrate only on Nobel Prize winners, because
there are many
factors.
And we haven't gone there yet to introduce the other doctors.
No, absolutely. Doctors have been a real... It's been a situation where the parents of many people felt that this was the point of achievement within their social and cultural lives. My son, the doctor. And that's possibly been a drive for many of the immigrants into South Africa to encourage the children to go into medicine. And if that was the only sole factor, I don't think we would really have done as well as doctors purely because of that. It possibly was the original impetus for many of us to go to university over the decades. But it's not only that. Jews have an exceptional record of being charitable, of having self-help groups. There were the...
If you look at the work the Chev does,
absolutely,
for example, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Without a doubt, it's unparalleled.
The amount of people they support and look after and care for.
Absolutely, within South Africa and almost within the world. I remember there was a figure that after the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, South Africans, the Jewish population per capita, gave more charity to Israel than virtually any other group in any other situation ever before. And that's been really part of it. It's an honorable profession, but it is a profession where one is able to give so much to the community, to an individual, and a kindness that really pervades so much of the way we live our lives that I think it's been a natural direction that many Jews have wanted to go. And it's always been that. There have been doctors who mentioned in the Talmud. There was Maimonides, the Rambam, who was the doctor to the Sultan, who was actually invited, in addition, to be the physician for Richard the First, the Lionhearted. But he could only be a doctor for one. And over many, many centuries, doctors and Jews have been the same one and same person.
It's interesting that you mentioned Maimonides. In my early days of learning about Judaism, I found this book in a bookstore called The Guide to the Perplexed, which I thought was going to be a sort of a ABC of Judaism. And I don't think I got past the introduction, and I don't think I've ever got past the first chapter. It is so complicated, and I eventually described it as a guide to be perplexed. You know, a great man, but I could never understand his work.
Absolutely. Well, it's a highly complex book, and it's certainly not a beginner's guide to Judaism.
Definitely not. It's not the dummy's guide to Judaism, although it seems to be presented that way, and that's why I was fooled into buying the book, you know.
Yeah, well, fooled not, but, you know, maybe it was, I think in your situation, you were looking to find ideas as to Judaism, and it seems to be kind of a catchy title, which it very much is not.
A very modern title for a book, too.
Without a doubt. Yes. Well, Maimonides was quite a tremendous figure. He redacted the entire Shulchan Aruch. He was a physician who spent many hours of his day seeing patients. He wrote other books on various other topics and was really absolutely exceptional. It says on his tomb, he was buried in Tiberias, in Tiberias, Mimosha ad Moshe lo kam kamosha, that from Moses, our teacher, to Moses, Maimonides, there was none like Moses. And he is one who is absolutely exceptional. But again, going not necessarily only are the exceptional important. I think the regular, common doctor who does so much work for the community is recognized as what he's doing. And we sometimes look at the greats, the very famous Nobel Prize winners, the other professors or people who've gone and led departments overseas as South Africans. But those who are here and who are on the ground and provide medical care for families and go on further and further, it's not only the famous who are doing that work. It's the regular GP, the regular specialist who spends much of his time doing what he has to do to try and make his patients well.
So are there a few examples that you'd like to talk about? I know one person who we haven't mentioned is Sidney Amwell's, who did this.
Percy Amwell's.
Percy Amwell's, who really revolutionized eye surgery.
Absolutely.
In terms of cataracts and fixing people who are myopic.
Yeah, without a doubt. He advanced what's called cryosurgery in the 1960s, and always it's kind of been difficult as to how to get into the eye. The eye is a very delicate organ.
Oh, I'm short-sighted, and I don't want anyone to go near mine.
Well, you should kind of consider doing laser therapy. You know, it may take care of all your problems. But
No.
You know,
you have to go through the operation when you're awake and you're watching what someone does. I'm afraid I don't go that way.
I understand, you know, and we very much are aware of that. But the problem was how to do delicate procedures within a very careful area of the body. And what he did was that he developed a probe that was very, very cold, that would kind of freeze onto the lens, to be able to remove that lens and allow a second lens to be put into the eye. He removed the cataract from President Nelson Mandela's left eye. And Thabo Mbeki, who was the second president of the New South Africa, awarded him a special award because of excellence in the field of ophthalmology. So both gynae and ophthalmology have used his inventions. And it's been really the foundation stone of modern ophthalmological treatment. He did a lot of work in terms of radial keratotomies, which was a way of making minute, very shallow cuts into the cornea and allowing the eye, using quite exceptional treatment, to no longer need to have such strong glasses. So his work has been really wonderful, Percy Amoyles. I've worked with great doctors myself. I count it as one of my exceptional privileges in life to have been the assistant of Myron Langer, who in my mind was a most wonderful, kind, exceptionally able surgeon who passed away a few years ago.
Rabbi, can we have a quick break and we'll be back in a few seconds.
Okay.
This is Legends and Legacies with Mark Wade.
Listening to 101.9 Chai FM, my name is Mark Wade. The program is Legends and Legacies, a history of South African Jewry. In studio, I have Rabbi Dr. Moshe Singer. We're talking about the valuable contributions that many South African Jewish doctors have made, going back to the early days when Max Thiele received a Nobel Prize in 1951, all the way through to Michael Levitt fairly recently in 2013. One of the people I'd like to bring up is Dr. Jonathan Gluckman, who's a pathologist, also based in Johannesburg, who on his wall had a sign that said, "Good men have only to remain silent for evil to prevail." And interestingly enough, he was one of the doctors who discovered during post-mortems that many of the anti-apartheid activists who supposedly died under mysterious circumstances during the apartheid regime had actually been murdered. And he obviously created quite an issue with the government at the time, but he was adamant that the post-mortems that he had done had proved his point. And he really went on to focus on the suspicious deaths of many other political activists. And although his work has really been largely unnoticed, unfortunately, and even his reports have been treated as being fake, he really has made an incredible contribution towards the investigative side of medicine. Rabbi, do you have much knowledge of Dr. Jonathan Gluckman?
Okay, Dr. Gluckman, interestingly enough, was one of the few private forensic pathologists in South Africa. What work he did was that he was a consultant in terms of the investigation of unnatural death. There's a law in South Africa that if a person dies under unnatural circumstances, there's a compulsory post-mortem that has to be done. And that can be in many different kind of situations, suicides, deaths, murders, any unnatural cause of death if a person dies having an operation. So there's what's called a forensic pathological examination as a post-mortem to try and work out why that person died. So why do you need it? Well, it's pretty obvious. If a person's murdered, you want to try and find out who did the killing. And once you've caught the perpetrator, you have to prove that he actually did the deed. So it's extremely scientific. It kind of ties up criminology and pathology. And Jonathan Gluckman was one who worked independently on behalf of families in terms of working out the cause of death.
So families were, during that time, were actually contracting him as an independent to assess the death of their family members.
It would be. You know, it not necessarily was it only in people, because it happened later that he was called on to look at, the first person he was asked to check over was Steve Biko
in 1977, I believe. Yes.
He was asked to look into the death of Steve Biko, and it really changed his career. He now, at that point, he put out a dossier where he felt that the claim of the South African government at the time was incorrect. He wrote to President de Klerk at the time. President de Klerk was not at that time. But last year, it says the year before he died, which was in 1993, he had written a dossier to President de Klerk where he said that things were not as it seemed to be. There was, in July of that year, he examined the body of one Simon Mtumkulu, who was a teenager of Sebokeng, who died under police interrogation, and he said, this brought me over the threshold. He lay there, horribly battered, horribly tortured, and dead. He said it could have been his grandson. So at the age of 77, he decided to break the habits of a lifetime and spoke out to the public. The government said that to do a comprehensive investigation was never materialized. And then they tried to discredit him with that he's old, that he really couldn't, his wits weren't really there. And his senior pathologists who were employed by the state, they kept quiet. So Gluckman, they said, faced the music alone.
It's interesting that with this Steve Biko in particular, it was another Jew, Helen Ziller, who actually, she was a journalist then, I think it was with the Rand Daily Mail. I'm not too sure which newspaper she was with, but she broke the story.
It may have been. I'm not certain about that, unfortunately. But somebody who I do know is the advocate Bezos, who wrote a book, No One to Blame, where he was brought in as an advocate at various various court cases into the death of people who died in custody. And some of the very famous people who died, Neil Agut was the first white who died in custody for political accusations. He died at John Forster Square, was found hanging at the end of a rope.
There were so many mysterious deaths during that
There period. Were a number. And he spoke out, Advocate Bezos, against the so-called nobody to blame. And I think the similar thing was Jonathan Gluckman, where as a private pathologist and came to the fore speaking on behalf of families, who wasn't prepared to just say, well, it didn't happen, we don't know what happened. He said he knew exactly what has happened and challenged the government in terms of taking responsibility for people who had died in custody and not just to be passed over that it just happened to be that way. He took a very important role as a pathologist. He stuck to his guns and was prepared to take on the authorities head on.
Another very interesting person who we used to go to school together, in fact, Barney Hurwitz, who started Clinical Holdings, which then became Netcare. He really was a great person, philanthropist, historian, and many, his children are still around. And I think he was of Polish and Russian origin, I believe. But he really was a very interesting person and made a great contribution towards private medical centers, really.
Well,
from the early days when I think he started off as a pharmacist in Fordsburg, and then apparently befriended anti-apartheid activist Yusuf Dadu and Nelson Mandela and Ahmed Kathrada. And at one point in his life, he actually hid all of them away from the security police.
Okay, those stories I don't know.
Absolutely fascinating. Obviously, Clinic Holdings is now a huge business concern. And then in a similar vein, we've got Lynette and Ivan Saltzman with Dischem Pharmacies. A great business.
It is.
Not strictly, it is medical. They're not doctors, but...
They're pharmacists.
They're pharmacists.
And pharmacists, as well as, in addition to doctors who've been involved in family and patient care, so pharmacists. They've been often
chat to them.
Absolutely. They've been the first line that patients often come to complain about their illnesses. They have not yet felt that they are sick enough to go to a doctor yet. Maybe they can't afford to go to a doctor. So the first port of call is often the pharmacy. And really over decades, the pharmacist has been a very important gatekeeper in terms of patient care. They've given wonderful advice. They've been very clinically astute many times. The way they feel a little bit out of their depth, they've advised their client to become a patient and go on to doctors. And without a doubt, the local pharmacist has been very, very important in terms of giving good care to the community. And you mentioned Albert Salzman. He's got the Discam Foundation, where they give large amounts of money for various social care programs. And again, that is another example as to how much Jews are involved with giving care to both the Jewish and the secular general community over many, many years in terms of health, in terms of charity, in terms of just kindness.
Well, Lynette's foundation, I believe she runs the Discam Foundation, that's Ivan's wife. She talks about starting a loyalty program, and then I think out of that kind of feeling where the loyalty is giving back to their customers, then they started working with NGOs, and I know that she's done work with orphanages and rehab centers, abandoned babies, old age homes. They've got mobile clinics around the country. So that philanthropic element has always been a very important part of the Jewish community. And we're talking about the Chevra Kedisha and various other organizations, and of course the great philanthropists Bertie Lubner and Nati Kirsch. That list goes on and on.
Without a doubt. And again, that's the way that our Jewish community has been brought up, to do kind things, to give charity, to do what's expected of a Jew and a human being within society. And great philanthropic efforts have been done and made by great people within our community. Large amounts of money. And we as secular people and we as doctors know how much kindness, how much money is given to people who can't afford care. And these people open their pockets and do tremendous work and give things to look after the community at large.
But going back to the Chev, I mean, I assume there are many medical practitioners who work with that environment, considering they've got frail care, they've got Arcadia to look after the young kids. It's an incredible network of social support. So it may not strictly be GPs or physiologists or, you know, specialists, but essentially it's an emotional support and a physical support in many ways that, to me, really makes our community.
Well, I can talk in absolute personal capacity. For over 30 years, I'm one of the doctors for the Chevra Kedisha, either working at our parents' home or working at Sanrium Gardens. My mornings are spent looking after the elderly, and all of us, currently there are four doctors who are all GPs and work very hard at keeping the elderly healthy. We also look after Selwood and Siegel, where there's a fifth doctor, and I personally am involved in running a clinic there, an outpatients clinic there once a week. So the Chevra Kedisha, well, without a doubt, that's a lot of what I do. And we have consultant specialists who come, who give their time, dermatologists, cardiologists, neurologists. We have a gynecologist who we can ask for help, and radiological services. There are tremendous support groups who help the medical care at the Chevra Kedisha.
There's medical, emotional, and physical.
Oh, without a doubt. There's Jewish social services, the psychologists. Many of the Chevra clients get a great deal of help from Sanrium Gardens, from the Chevra. They have to be careful because they can't spread themselves too thin. They can't give everything to everybody. But things are looked at very carefully, and what people need in the community, they are pretty much given. And the Chevra is an exceptional body of people. I feel very privileged to be one of the doctors working for them, because I see really at grassroots levels how much we have to do and are privileged to do to help our sick and less fortunate people within our community.
And I assume that all those organizations really rely on private funding.
for sure.
Which I assume must be quite a difficult task.
It is many, many, many millions, not tens, but hundreds of millions are required every year. I'm not here to give a plug for the Hebra, but believe me, the amounts of money that are needed are unbelievable. Unfortunately, we have a shrinking Jewish population, and the requirements of the community are going up, not going down. So the donors, the supporters of the Hevra, are absolutely vital to the continuing care and health of our community.
We've had Rabbi Silverhaft in the studio talking about the country communities. And it's also, I think, kudos to him for going round to the, I think there's more than 1,500 country communities, and most of them, as you say, the shrinking population, people have moved to the big centres for work. But you know, so there's someone who goes around, looks after the old synagogues, looks after the old graveyards, makes sure the fences are there, makes sure the grass is cut, really caring for the community. And I think that's something that I can never ever. None of us actually can ignore the things that the community does. We have schools, we have medical facilities. There's a support network second to none. I don't know whether there's any other community within the secular world that really look after the people the way we do.
Undoubtedly. And I must say, even within Jewish communities, you've got to look very, very far to find a Jewish community as supportive of as the South African Jewish community. I'm one who helps doing Tarot at the cemetery on a voluntary basis. And all of us, in our ways, pitch in to help the community in fantastic ways. One of the statements of the Hevra is no one will be left behind. At this time of the year, I'm not here to give a plug for them, but really, I know how many people need help. So if I can give a totally unrelated plug, give your money over to the Hebra, because your next door neighbor probably needs some help and they're getting it from them.
With those very supportive words, Rabbi, thank you very much for joining me in the studio today. It's been fascinating. I know we haven't touched on the vast number of doctors and specialists in all the different fields, but thanks again for coming to join me in the studio today.
Mark, it was great. Thank you very much for having me come.
My name is Mark Wade. You've been listening to 101.9 Chai FM. We'll see you next week.